What if the most important legal battles, the ones that shaped lives, shattered systems, and rewrote laws, were the ones no one ever told you about? This podcast uncovers those stories, the unheard truths behind real legal injustice. And along the way, you'll meet the people who lived them, fought them, or exposed them. Some are brilliant, some are bold, and some are outright hilarious. All of them you will find to be unforgettable. Welcome to Cases for Causes, where justice gets personal, nothing stays buried. So I gave this some thought, and number one, welcome to season three, our first episode with a returning guest, Jessica Pride. Happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm excited you asked me back.
Absolutely.
Clearly, I didn't mess it up the first time. So, or you just wanted a train wreck back on for ratings, I think.
Well, we got some pretty big news. I understand you won a big award. Was it last weekend?
I did. I'm very honored and privileged to have won Consumer Advocate of the Year. And for such a really important case, it's a record-breaking first of its kind in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. Verdict on behalf of, well, settlement, I should say, on behalf of survivors in prison. But I hope it really changes things.
I certainly hope so, too. And I think part of a good place to start understanding is because I was just having a dinner last night and I was talking to people and they're like, oh, you work with attorneys? And I said, yeah. And I said, what different types? And I was telling them about today's recording. And a woman says to me, she goes, there's sexual assault attorneys. Like, that's all they do. And I was using, like, well, it's like, you know, you go to see a doctor about certain things, like whether it's, you know, they work with cancer or they work with different parts of the body. And yes, attorneys have specialized and diversified. So can we go back to, like, maybe all the way back to even when the first time I really met you and started talking to you about how you got into this area of practice, because it is extremely specialized. And I didn't really remember hearing about sexual assault cases 20 years ago. And then, you know, there was the pre-sexual abuse. Where was the genesis, would you say, of the practice area?
So, God, I've been doing sexual assault cases and child sex abuse cases for, oh, I'm going to date myself now, a good like 20 years. I'm sorry I've been doing this work for so long, because I keep saying, as you know, I've said, I'd love to not have a job and do this work, but unfortunately it's been needed. And yes, I only do sexual assault cases. One, because it's specialized and I think we provide a better product when you're really looking at litigation through a trauma-informed lens. But two, just because we're so busy. We used to diversify and do PI cases, you know, car crashes, dog bites, slip and falls. And we just had so many sexual assault cases. And it's the stuff I love and passionate about. We just thought, we're just going to do that. But I started, God, 20 years ago, I got my first case. And it was one of those moments where I realized, this doesn't feel like work. I'm actually really passionate about helping survivors. And I was able to, I did a lot of philanthropy. I've always done, you know, I was a big brother, big sister for a long time. And then after that, I did Make-A-Wish. Then I went to volunteer at our local rape crisis center. And so it was an opportunity to take my skills as an attorney, as an advocate, and then to help survivors and marry the two. And so it was kind of like a beautiful thing was born.
Sounds like it turned into your calling.
It 100%. It was like all things in life. I was meant to do that. And it definitely is something that fuels my passion, is something I'm excited about. And I've been really happy to go on this journey and to think about how to practice law differently. I know when I talk to you, God, we've been working together for, it's got to be 15 years.
Forever. I don't want to date me. Don't date me.
Okay. I won't date you because you don't look a day over 24, like when we were first hanging out. But, you know, back in the day when you were working in your living room and I was working in my living room trying to build something, and it was, how do I create a firm for survivors that speaks to survivors, that is, does it in a way that kind of protects survivors through the process? And that was back when I don't think anybody really, I mean, there's a couple stalwarts that were around at that time, but there definitely weren't all the Me Too law firms that there are now.
Right.
And we did. You created, back then it was victim lawyer.
Right.
And then we created survivor lawyer. And it kind of just grew from there. And remember, we sat down and we even thought about colors. Like, what colors for, we don't want it to look like a law firm website.
Exactly.
Because that'd be the worst. Because who wants to hire like that person? And so what makes a survivor feel welcomed and feels like we get it and we care and we realize that justice is more than, most of the time it's not about the money. It's about holding someone responsible. And for a survivor to hear, it's not your fault. Like, it's not your fault. And we're here to help you. So I think we've come a long way. We've come a long way from what we created, from our living rooms to now we've got offices with tons of employees and it's thriving.
You've created a safe space. I remember that was, it's not your fault was one thing that we had written down, but also we would say internally in the office when we meet around, be like, how are we creating a safe space in a web? And that was nothing we've ever really considered before and how important it needed to be.
Yeah. And now people are copying us.
Now they do. Now they do.
I guess copying is the ultimate form of flattery. But yeah, I'm surprised sometimes when I actually, one, see people are actually paying for ads. So when people Google my name, it actually, you know, they pop up on the banner on Google, or how people have actually literally taken our entire site and just copied it. You're like, wow, could you at least like come up with maybe some of your own ideas?
I guess we've been doing it okay so far.
Yeah.
So getting into talking about, and how should I refer to it even? Should I refer to them as prison cases? Should I refer to them as, you know, incarcerated individuals, incarcerated survivors?
I mean, in the class of cases, right, they are prison cases. But I think if you're going to ask a survivor what they want to be called, it's really particular to survivor. Some survivors see themselves as victims. Some survivors see themselves as survivors. And then other people don't want that word survivor because it somehow anchors them. And so they like the word thriver. But I always let each person gets to choose where they are on their journey and what title resonates for them. We're just here to guide them on their journey to justice.
So let's start with going back to how you heard of the first case, and I want to focus on California for a moment, but I know we got to talk about beyond California at some point.
Yeah.
How did the first case come about to your attention, and what caught your attention in terms of, was it details? Was it the story? Was it, there's, by the way, a number of other women that also have been affected.
Yeah. So I got the first call at FCI Dublin about the abuse that was happening there through a phone call. And a woman called the office. She reported that she had been incarcerated at FCI Dublin. She was currently at that time in a halfway house. Mm-hmm. So she felt like she had a little bit of freedom from the trauma and the retaliation that she was enduring in FCI Dublin, where she felt safe enough to at least pick up the phone and call me. She told a story that while she was there, a prison guard took a liking to her and then was her boss at her job that she had while she was at FCI Dublin. And then during her shift, he would ask her to go into the recycling bin, which essentially it's a big metal conics container. If you ever, do you remember, I don't know, sometimes schools have them, those big metal containers on the end of the playground where they put all the, you know, balls and all these things. Well, that's what they did. They used one for recycling. They also used some for like outdoor activities and put supplies in there. And so he would have her go into the conics box, and there were no cameras in the conics box. And there's generally not cameras in the conics box at prisons, which there should be, because they are definitely a location where abuse happens. And then he would have her go into the box and he'd rape her. And because shocking, there was a couch in the conics box. Like, hello, is anybody paying attention? I mean, the amount of stuff that we uncovered that was happening at FCI Dublin that enabled such abuse is really shocking. You would think, so we did a tour. We go into a tour and I couldn't believe it. I mean, you would think at a prison, they would have cameras in every corner. Why not? Right? Because you need to watch people. No, they didn't. And half of them, and the ones that they did have, half of them weren't working. And then they did go to a central command unit, but no one was watching the cameras. So this was a situation where if something happened and it happened to be in a location where there was an active camera, then somebody would go back and watch the tape and say, okay, did, you know, X, did the fight happen or what happened? So it really wasn't a system to monitor the inmates, nor was it a way that they could monitor abuse and prevent any type of abuse. But what we know now at FCI Dublin is that they weren't trying to monitor abuse, because everyone from the warden to the chaplain were in on it, including the PREA rep. So there was no one to report to. And that's what they were doing. They were reporting and they were saying, help me, this guard is raping me, or this guard is touching me inappropriately. And so you would fill out a BP9 or you'd fill out a PREA complaint, and those complaints would go to the either the PREA rep who was in on it, who would then tell his buddies, hey, this person's snitching on you, or every complaint went to the warden. And so when it went to the warden would then go and tell, and then you would get penalized. So you would get thrown in solitary housing unit. You would have your commissary privileges taken away. You would have your room tossed, your good time, which good time is, that's discounted time on your sentence. Imagine losing months of time, being forced to stay incarcerated for months more because you asked for help. So these women realized quickly that there was no help inside. And so then they started on a letter writing campaign, and they started writing to Senator Speer, to, you know, all these different senators in California and outside, also saying like, help me, help me, help me. But I mean, public officials get tons of mail complaining about all kinds of things. And the stories were, I mean, fantastical. You thought, is this really happening? Because when I talked to the first client, I thought, well, this is horrific. This can't really be happening. And she goes, no, it's not just happening to me. It's happening to everybody. And I was like, okay, come on. Like everybody? And she's like, a lot of people. Like I could tell you, I could name X, Y, and Z. And the guys and the guards are threatening us. He's already come to see me outside of prison, which is scary. And so it came kind of into play, was like, you need to talk to FBI and OIG, which OIG is the Office of Inspector General. They're the police of the police. She did. And thankfully, the U.S. Attorney's Office decided to prosecute.
And yeah, it sounds like a systemic failure where everything is already bad. And I didn't understand until this conversation that the retaliation part of reporting it would even make it worse, and especially the taking away of that. That, did you call it good time?
Yeah, you have good time. So they took away their commissary privileges. So the reason why commissary privileges are important is that you need to realize that when you're in prison, it's not like, first of all, it's not like a hotel. This is the worst hotel you could ever stay at, where, you know, they didn't have hot water sometimes. They had cold water only. So it's Northern California. It gets cold up there. And you got to take a shower in cold water. On top of that, they had the worst black mold problem. So now you're coughing. You have horrible respiratory infections and issues because they've got black mold. They didn't have enough heaters in different areas and locations. They didn't give them blankets to keep them warm. The food half the time was rotten. I mean, there were so many other poor living conditions that they had to endure. But their shower, for example, didn't come with shampoo and conditioner. There was like this like one kind of all-purpose kind of like chalk soap, but it's not something you'd want to like wash your hair with. So if you want shampoo or you want conditioner, you have to buy it from commissary. If you want to have detergent to wash your clothes, you have to buy it from commissary. If you want to eat tuna, let's say they have packaged tuna because you don't want to eat the rotten like maggot-filled meat or mystery meat, whatever they're serving, you have to buy it for commissary. But what happens when they take away your commissary privileges? Now you can't wash your hair. Can't wash your hair. You are cold because if you need a blanket, you have to buy it from commissary. You want to have sweats, extra pants, commissary. But then when they penalize you and they then will toss your rep, they call it tossing your cell because they think you have contraband, they take all your stuff. So then all of a sudden they throw, or if you get thrown away, you get sent to the SHU, they get rid of all your things.
The SHU?
Solitary housing unit, which is just an ultimately terrible place for any human. And there's a reason why people go mentally crazy when they're stuck in the SHU for too long, because literally, I mean, the cell is smaller than this room. It's 23 hours a day in solitary with no light and literally the worst fluorescent lighting you've ever seen. And it's all metal. And, you know, it's a tiny cot with a tiny little shower and a toilet. You could do all the things while you're sitting in the toilet. You could like touch your bed. I mean, this is like very small. There's not even enough space. Like you're not doing exercise in there. And then for 1 hour a day, you are let outside into the equivalent of what is worse than a dog kennel. It's just a cement pad, a 5 foot cement pad with barbed wire all around. You don't get a ball. You don't get anything to like a jump rope to play with or something. And interesting, when we visited, there were little squirrels that came to like see us. And I asked the person giving us the tour, I said, why are they? And they said, that's their friends. That prisoners would save like crumbs of their food and would give them to the squirrels because that was the only contact they had all day. And so the squirrels actually became somewhat domesticated. But can you imagine if that was the thing you look forward to every day was going out to sit on the pad to feed crumbs to squirrels?
23 hours a day, you get the 1 hour to be outside, get some sunlight, do nothing else, but you at least had your squirrel friend.
Right. Assuming it was not raining and it's also outside of Oakland. So we know how the weather is up there.
Right.
The conditions were absolutely terrible. My dog, when it goes to like, you know, the dog boarding, is better than this. And so if you threaten somebody with going to the solitary housing unit, which is what they did with some of the first women who came forward and tried to report that they were abused there, they sent them there for months. And the one woman that everybody talks about, all my clients talked about, she literally went crazy after 3 months, cracked out, never came back, lost her sanity. Something in her just broke. And now she is, I mean, for all intents and purposes, kind of schizophrenic. And so the women looked at that and went, I don't want that to happen to me. And if they take away my time or add time onto my sentence, I'm never getting out of here. I'm never getting out of here. I'm never going to see my family again. And I don't care what people think about incarcerated people. If you commit a crime, your punishment is you go to jail. Your punishment is not you get raped by the correctional officer that is supposed to take care of you. That is completely unacceptable. It's inhumane. There is a reason why in the United States of America, that is illegal. Inmates cannot consent. I don't give a shit what people think. Oh, well, she probably wanted it or she complied. You can't. You can't. There is an imbalance of power. How can a woman say, yes, I want to engage in whatever sexual activity with this person if that person controls where I get to go, controls how I get to eat, controls if I get a blanket, controls if I get to get out on time or not, or get out early? You can't consent. And then what if you change your mind? Where are you going to go? You going to leave? You're going to be like, hey, leave me alone. I'm going to go home this weekend and think about it. No, that it's illegal. It's illegal. And people need to understand that prisoners cannot consent.
Absolutely. I understand that the penitentiary system is something that I think a lot of people just don't understand unless you've ever gone or you have a family member who may also be even strong enough to tell you about how horrific the conditions were. They're not a POW, right? They made a crime and this is their punishment. If it's happening in FCI Dublin and it's happening in some other prisons in California, I can only imagine this is something that has got to be happening in other prisons throughout the US.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think it's an epidemic that has taken over the prison system. What I've noticed through these cases and now representing prisoners across the country is that, like we saw with Catholic Church cases, like we see with schools, when BOP found out it had a bad correctional officer, instead of terminating them, what'd they do? They moved them. It's the term we called pass the trash. Mm-hmm. So they just moved that correctional officer to a different facility. And then what happens when you think they got to that facility? Well, then they sexually abuse people there. And, you know, with FCI Dublin, they also shut that prison down, which is amazing. First prison that's been shut down because of sexual violence and all of the trauma and stuff that was happening there. But that left hundreds of employees with unemployment, or at least having to look for a new facility to work at. You know, there are a number of people that were placed on administrative leave or who've been prosecuted, but there also are people who have gone undetected, or maybe not got detected, but got away with it, or were moved before, you know, things really hit the fan. So they're now at federal prisons across the country. And we are seeing the same type of abuse pop up across the country. I think part of the reason why is because of the way PREA is structured right now. Not every prison complies with PREA.
Help us understand, help me understand, what is it? What is PREA? What is its role? Is it something that's supposed to safeguard some of the prisoners?
So PREA is the Prison Rape Elimination Act. The purpose of PREA is to prevent rape and sexual assault of inmates while incarcerated. And each state gets to choose if they want to comply. They're supposed to all comply. But if you don't comply, you just get fined. And certain states in the South just take the fine. And so California complies. I mean, it does its part to comply, right? And what PREA does is it says, okay, if a prisoner feels like they're being sexually abused, they can file a PREA complaint that then goes off to DOJ, who then is supposed to do an investigation and look into, you know, the allegations. It also then requires that prisons undergo a PREA audit, meaning a rep comes, looks at the prison, talks to prisoners, talks to the PREA rep at that subject prison to see if they're in compliance. And every year they're supposed to do this and go, okay, yes, we see they have safeguards in place. Yes, we see we talk to prisoners and they're feeling fine. And yes, there's someone for them to report to. And how they report is clearly, you know, posted. But the problem with it, what we saw in FCI Dublin was, is that PREA reps can't just show up whenever. They have to notify the prison and say, okay, we'll be there in 2 weeks on Tuesday. And, you know, can you have all these people available? Well, if you're doing bad things at the prison, what do? You got 2 weeks to transfer inmates out so that they can't talk to any of the, you know, to the auditor. You have, you know, time to get everything to threaten people into silence. You have time to get your ducks in a row and make it look like you're doing your job when you're not. Part of the problem, too, is that the people that they're paying to do the audits are being paid for by the prison. So there's kind of this conflict of interest. I'm not so sure if the PREA auditors are really as neutral as we'd like them to be. And so, because if you think about this, FCI Dublin passed all its audits. Good job, buen trabajo, like flying colors, here we go. And that was the farthest from the truth. I mean, it literally has been termed the rape club. How does the rape club pass a PREA audit? There's a failure. There's a breakdown in coverage here. So I really think that PREA had really great intentions. I do think that there are some good things in PREA, but some things need to be adjusted. And I think that all prisons need to comply. I think there need to be independent auditors who can come in whenever they want without advanced warning. I think that the auditor shouldn't have some kind of protections that they're not worried that if they say the wrong thing, that that's going to affect their job or future, you know, audits. There also has to be a system in place of laws that hold people accountable when they do commit crimes. And what we're seeing is that the laws in, let's say, California in the Ninth Circuit are much better than, let's say, down in Alabama in the 13th Circuit. And down in the South, I mean, there are some laws that just make you, it makes my blood boil. And I can't believe in this day and age in a civilized society that there's actually a case that down in the South that says there's immunity for correctional officers who rape and sexually abuse prisoners. How are you immune? How is that somehow a whoopsies that the government gets to be like, eh? But prisoners don't have rights in certain circuits and jurisdictions. So I think it's a job for lawyers to fight the fight, for us to put judges in place that understand human rights and that care about human rights. You know, there is, it's not just going to be one thing that changes it. I think people need to realize, and I think people probably listening to this understand the importance of having fair and equitable judges.
What happens if it's just like with sexual assault? It's just with child sexual assault. Like when a child comes and tells you about these things, it's important. It's time to listen. It's time to ask more questions. It's really time to let's hear it out.
Right.
So what would be the type of advice to give someone if a family member hears from an incarcerated family member that they are being abused? What kind of advice can you give them as far as handling the situation, even if they don't take action right away, but maybe they choose to? What do you think they should do?
I'd start with what I always tell people is believe survivors. The rate of false reporting is super low, and with children, even lower. So if a child tells you that they've been abused, I'd bet money on it they have been. And with adults, that's the same thing. Start from that place. Believe a survivor when they tell you they've been abused, and then get some more information. Here's the problem. If they're talking to their loved one on a prison call, it's being recorded. And if your abuser is a correctional officer, what they did at FCDM, they were listening to the calls and then suffered retaliation. So if you can go and have the conversation in person, but see, here's the thing. It depends what kind of facility it is. Because some of the facilities are like what you see on TV, right? And there's the glass and then you're talking on the phone. Those are also being recorded. So if it's a visit where you're able to be face-to-face without any plexiglass in the middle, then maybe it's safe to get some information there. Or if the survivor feels comfortable writing it, they do read their mail, but can do it in terms that, you know, if it's in code or something where a family member understands what's happening, or they just want to tell their family member because they just feel like they have no hope and no options. Then I would say gather the evidence. The incarcerated people, depending on what type of facility they're in, if they're in a federal prison, they can file a PREA complaint that should go to DOJ and start an investigation. However, I will tell you they are so backed up, thousands of complaints. It may take months, years for them to get to them, which in the meantime, someone's still being abused. You can file in a BP 8, 9. Those are complaint forms within the prison. If the prisoner feels that whoever's there, like SAS is usually who does the investigations, but sometimes like in Dublin, SAS was in on it. So in those circumstances, then contact a lawyer. And so we have a lot of family members who contact our office and say, this is what my family members reported. They're saying all of these things. What do you think? And then we can give some advice as to what the family should do. And if we are interested in taking the case or learning more, we can set up a prison call, a legal visit, and then those calls aren't recorded. So because of the attorney-client privilege, then survivors can feel at least a little safe. They feel safer or have the confidence that what they tell us is between us. And then we can go and issue complaints, call OIG, do other things to help them. Another thing two people did with FCA Dublin was they wrote to their, you know, to their politicians in their area. And we know in California, Senator Speer was wonderful and believed survivors went out there, demanded to be able to go into the prison, demanded to be able to see and demanded change. So there are some amazing. Senator Ossoff's office did a investigative hearing and looked into all of this with Senator Booker, and they are wonderful champions for human rights. And it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you sit on. These are human issues. These are issues that affect everyone, and how we treat our most vulnerable population says a lot about us as a society. And so I think it's important that we remember that and remember that being abused is not part of someone's sentence. It's actually inhumane treatment. It's cruel and unusual punishment. That's what the law says.
Yeah, it sounds like the prison system is, as you have enlightened me now, inherently it has all of these kind of security layers to enable the guards or people who may oversee the guards to have this behavior continue. And the prisoners also know that everything's being recorded. So it seems like one of the best things to do, besides A, believe them, to do something about it, see if you can speak with a lawyer to set up an attorney-client private call.
Yep. Or file a complaint.
And filing a complaint and some education back to also the prisoner, giving them some hope. I mean, we don't know that any of the prisoners even know or are aware of what's happened.
Right.
Hopefully some have. And they exchange that information.
I had a prisoner. I actually went to the South a couple weeks ago and visited an inmate. And she said she actually saw me on the news from her prison cell. She saw me on the news talking about Dublin, and it gave her the courage to call because she said, wait, you actually can do something about this? You actually can stop this from happening? You can help me? And I mean, she cried when I showed up, and she's like, I can't believe you came, and I can't believe you're going to try and help me. And the phone has been ringing constantly since people found out about FCI Dublin. All the lawyers that were involved have said the same thing. We are just inundated with cases right now from abuse that's happening all over the country. It's really sad.
Now that exactly what you're saying, the FCI Dublin, the word is getting out, people are understanding better. Can you share, this is a two-part question. I was wondering if you could share if there's anything that surprises you or saddens you about what more you are learning about outside of California?
Yeah. I would say what saddens me is to see what the law is like in the South. Prisoners have less rights there than they do here in California, in the Ninth Circuit, or let's say in New York. Which, shouldn't the rights of humans be universal? Shouldn't people be protected no matter where you are at in the country? Because survivors don't choose, the inmates don't choose. They're not like, hey, you know what? I think I want to go to Aliceville. No, the prison system decides where they're going. If you're lucky, you get, you would have got Dublin or there's another prison here in California. But if you pull Aliceville, that's like, oof, that wasn't the choice I would pick. It is not good down there.
Do you see that there is any kind of effort with education of prison staff and guards and informing them that you may already know that this behavior is not to be tolerated, but here, now we're really changing?
Well, President Trump terminated within his first week of office. He terminated Colleen Peters, head of BOP, and really said her and her administration did a terrible job at protecting inmates from sexual abuse, and that the stuff that happened at FCI Dublin was indicative of how poor of a job she did. And he and his administration have vowed to do better. And so I'm hoping they're learning from what happened at FCI Dublin and saying, what can we do different? Let's make sure the cameras are working in the prisons. Let's make sure that the reporting process is clear. Most survivors didn't have access to, PREA complaints. And so it should be a drop-down menu in their core links, which is their prison email. That should go straight to DOJ or OIG. What else can we do about training? What can we do about investigations, and how do we clear out the backlog? So I definitely think that there are things that have been learned through this process. I think it's interesting too, because there was an injunctive relief case that went alongside the civil lawsuit for damages and for the loss of quality of life. And in that injunctive relief case, they were wonderful, and they had an amazing team of lawyers that worked to stop the abuse and to make sure that the mold was remediated, to make sure that, to try and stop the retaliation. But what's shocking, you had said, like, what shocked you through this? I was shocked that even after we got involved even after there's all these lawyers working on this case and there's a spotlight and Senator Ossoff's office is doing an investigation and you've got all these things happening that, you know, they fired the old administration, they put in a new, new warden, and he had his whole new executive team. And then they continued to retaliate. When we would go in to see our clients, after we went in to see them, they would then retaliate against them and toss their rooms, you know, tell them terrible things. They cut off their access, meaning they then weren't allowed to communicate with their families. They weren't allowed to have access to commissary, and they made it about, you know, security issues or some nonsense. And it was so bad that then those people got fired. So they went through two different, like, management teams. And it was finally to the point where Judge Gonzales Rogers, who was amazing on these cases, said, I'm appointing a special master because you guys can't get this right. So I feel like I need to have a special master there on property, on campus, to watch you to make sure that you are following the judge's orders, that you are actually not continuing to retaliate and to sexually abuse people. Because there were people still, after we filed the lawsuits, that were still getting sexually abused. So when that happened, BOP got pissed and they were like, absolutely not. You don't get to babysit us. You don't get to be here and tell us what to do. And they filed a motion to try and stop the special master. And the judge came back and said, oh no, you don't get to misbehave like that. The ruling stands. So then what do you think BOP did? BOP came back and said, well, then we're shutting down the prison. Sounds like a kid who, like, when didn't want to play anymore, you know, and then goes, well, I'm taking my ball and you don't get to play with me. Right. I'll teach you to tell me what the rules were. So they shut down the prison just because they didn't want to be watched anymore. And if you think, if you had nothing to hide, if you were going to follow the orders and do your job, why do that? Well, they came back and said, well, we can't do our job effectively with the structure we have. And so we're going to have to rethink the whole situation.
With the oversight.
And since then, now they've just said, well, we have no intention of ever opening it back up.
Do you think it's good? It may have gone that bad at this stage in terms of institutional accountability to have something like that happen. So you can identify a pattern down the line of this prison is now doing the same thing that Dublin was doing. And we know how that turned out. Do you think that may be something that could be used to the advantage?
I mean, here's the thing. Prison reform is expensive. So are lawsuits. At some point, they're going to go, we just got to do prison reform. Because if not, the lawsuits are going to keep coming. And I do want to say, I know we're kind of beaten up on the Bureau of Prisons right now, but there are a lot of men and women who work for BOP, who adhere to the law, who have dedicated their lives to, you know, keeping prisoners safe, to getting up and doing their job. And so for those people, I thank them. There are a lot of amazing people. It's just like lawyers, right? There's always the bad apples. There's always the people that think, you know, Tom Girardi's of the world are out stealing client money or, you know, running behind ambulances. No, we don't all do that. And it's really hard to run behind an ambulance in heels. So
Jessica, will you tell us how, after the investigation started, the initial individual that contacted you, can you give us a timeline of how it proceeded to a point where you ended up at a $117 million verdict? Settlement.
It was $117 million settlement. So it started off as one. It always is that way, right? One brave voice. And I'd like to just, considering the political climate right now and what people are saying about immigrants, and the first person who came forward as an immigrant. There were lots of women who were abused. Hundreds of women that were abused at FCI Dublin over 10 years. Do you know that it took one little immigrant woman to come forward and use her voice and call me? And that's what started to topple the dominoes. So when you think about the courage that it takes to come forward, also when you're potentially facing deportation, you have no support system. I'm always in awe of survivors. And this woman deserves like so much credit. And because her perpetrator was terrible. They're all terrible, but this one was particularly terrible. He literally threatened her, showed up at her parents. Her mother was still here. Went to her mother's, threatened her mother, tried to give her money, all kinds of stuff to silence her. So we filed her case 3 years ago. We filed her case 3 years ago, and then other people started to come forward, and one turned into 10, and 10 turned into 20, and next thing you know, there's 104. We were able to, we filed them all. We were all sent to YGR's department up in Oakland and essentially turned it into like a mini MDL. And then we started the litigation process and we decided to then go to mediation to try and resolve them. We were able to reach a global settlement of $117 million, after which point we then went on to an allocation process. So retired Judge Gail Andler, as well as Rhonda Trapp, both served as allocators. They interviewed 104 women in a month's time, which was amazing, and then made a determination as to how much each woman got. So I know it's seen in the news, some people are like, oh, everybody got roughly $1 million. No, it didn't really work that way because it was based on the type of, you know, some people were touched in the shower versus some people were raped and sodomized. Obviously, the woman who was raped and sodomized, she got the most money. She was $1.6 million, which that was this, that is to date the most any woman who's ever been raped in prison has been paid. Before that, the woman who got the most was 1.2, and also a horrific story. So we were able to at least raise the limit or the ceiling, so to speak. And then, I mean, it kind of went down from there for women who were like, they were looking at them in showers, things like that. It's a remarkable settlement if you think about it for survivors.
Do you think there are going to be more?
Unfortunately, yes. There are still more. There were a lot of people who were quiet, people who we talked to during that first round who didn't feel comfortable or safe coming forward. Now, having seen that the Attorney General had to sign off on this and did, and they actually then paid, a lot of people were worried. They have zero trust or faith in the government. So it's one of those things like, I'm not going to come forward to say anything because even if they tell me they're going to do something, nothing changes. And then they're going to screw me in the last minute. And the clients are really worried because, you know, with the government, it takes forever for anything to settle. So we reached a deal in July of last year, but the Attorney General didn't sign off on it until December. And then, you know, we have to work through payment and all that stuff. And so I can't tell you how many clients were like, they're going to change their minds. This isn't really happening. They're going to take it back. Or I'm going to get stuck in prison forever, or they're going to send me back, or whatever it was. And it was a challenge. It was a challenge to say to them, it's okay, you're safe. And so once things became apparent that it was actually going to stand, there's a wave of people who've come forward. So we now have a lot of people who've come forward in round two, we're calling it, for FCI Dublin. We also then, that sparked people to have the courage across the country to come forward and talk about the treatment they went through. There's people at Chowchilla. As you know, there's a big Chowchilla litigation going on in California. That's a state prison. You know, honestly, there's, I feel like all the prisons right now are having problems. I'd be better off if you asked me which ones are safe. Maybe I can pinpoint those ones. It's like asking me which psych ward would you send a loved one to? None.
Let me ask you a question about President Trump firing the head of the Bureau of Prisons, yep. BOP. Do you believe that that firing is related to the settlement?
Yes. And his press release said it was. So
that's making change.
It is. Let's hope this next person is better. You have an amazing opportunity. Do the right thing.
So there's another type of case that you've been handling, I think, for at least the past 8 or 10 years, to my knowledge. Can you explain a little bit of the background on that? That is one that most people, when they hear the subject matter, people are just left absolutely aghast at the idea of it.
Yeah, unfortunately, when you think about survivors, predators like people who are vulnerable. That's why autistic children are sexually abused at a higher rate. People in psych wards, prisons. But the other one is therapist, either a therapist office, or we see a lot of rehab facilities, especially high-end ones. And California is known for it, right? We've got everything from Betty Ford to all these fancy ones in Los Angeles. And you send your loved one there who is at the lowest point in their life where, you know, they're battling addiction or they're, you know, going through divorce or whatever it is. They lost their job or they just, you know, they had an ultimate, they just hit the bottom. And you go to someone for help. And you go into this room where you're there looking for advice and assistance. And then that person takes advantage of you and makes everything worse. So imagine taking that trauma, then you pile on sexual violence on top, and now where do you think that person is? They're just...
Must be devastated. I can't think.
How do you...
Between when you look at, you know, prison cases and some others, I'm not saying any of them are justified, but 100%, someone at their lowest point seeking help. I mean, we've heard Paris Hilton's story, I believe, is mostly involved with schools.
Yeah. Well, her parents sent her away to a facility for troubled children. Mm-hmm. There are facilities here in California as well where we've sued multiple times for teens who, you know, just an honorary teen, you know, maybe got into drugs, run away from home. Parents try to do the right thing and put them in a facility and then they get abused there. But, you know, you then take that trauma and make it worse. And what we know about children is that a lot of times children who act out, there's something going on at home, or they're victims of child sex abuse, or there's something underlying. Kids don't just decide to act out and do terrible things. I mean, some have mental health issues, but, you know, normally if the child doesn't have a history of mental health issues, something's going on. And mom and dad should say, why? What is going on? Let's talk to our children. But sometimes it's not in their bandwidth. You never know where people are, the way they grow up. You know, we both have kids, and mine didn't come with a manual about how to parent. I sometimes wish they did, because I at least would be like, that's why.
Do you think we're parents
figuring out on the fly?
Yeah. Do you think parents may often blame themselves first?
Sometimes. I mean, I've had parents who've come in once they've realized their kid was, let's say, molested by a teacher at school, and they feel like, my kid told me they didn't want to go to school and I forced them because I thought they were just being dramatic, or God, I know that he started acting kind of weird and was like isolating, but oh, I feel so bad. How could I let him go to school? Definitely. I see that. But I also see the parents who are just so overwhelmed with life. And you have to remember, maybe they were abused as children. And we know that the children of parents who were molested have a higher rate of being sexually abused, because those parents were groomed and they're not teaching their kids healthy boundaries and they're not catching on to the red flags that go, something's up, because they're not in a healthy headspace, right? And they're dealing with their own trauma, and then they're trying to pay the bills, and they're working, maybe they're working two jobs and they're doing the best they can and they're not paying attention. So I feel like we always have to have grace. You have to remember that until you've lived somebody else's life, you don't know what it's like. And it's not for us to judge. What we're here to do is to make sure that people who do commit crimes and sexually abuse people should be held accountable. And what can I do within my power to create change?
What do you wish people understood more about the legal process for sexual assault? Do you find that there's confusion?
I would say survivors are still confused. They're confused. I can't tell you how many times I have get a call and they're like, wait, I thought the criminal defense, I thought the criminal prosecutor was doing both of these things. Okay, no, they're two different systems. There's a criminal justice system and then there's a civil justice system. And you need a lawyer for civil justice. If you come forward and tell the police and the prosecutor, I mean, decides to pick up the case, you don't have to pay for a lawyer. A prosecutor does it, but you're not the client, right? You're just the star witness. Civil lawyers, you actually need to go and hire a civil lawyer who, I mean, you know, works on a contingency basis, so it doesn't cost you any money up front. But then that person gets you money for, you know, medical bills, counseling, therapy, loss of enjoyment of life, the quality of life as a result of what happened.
And more accountability too.
And more accountability, because through that process, a lot of times we can say in a settlement to schools, hey, well, now you have to institute some new training. Hey, we sued a psych ward. And because of that, they now segregated their psychiatric ward. What people don't realize is that actually the standard of the community is psych wards are co-ed. Imagine sending your mentally ill loved one, let's say woman, there, and they dope them up right when they come in because they're usually manic. And then within the first usually 24 to 48 hours is when someone's sexually abused. And you get someone, a male patient down the hallway who's a repeat offender. He's probably mentally, let's say that person's actually schizophrenic or something, but we know that mental illness comes with hypersexuality is usually one of the symptoms. And they do 15-minute bed checks, but they know that. So they do the bed check, wait, and then they run into the other room and rape the other person because they're short-staffed and people aren't paying attention. And so I guess, what do people not realize? You got two different systems. The other thing I think people don't realize is that, and we've talked about this so much and people are shocked, and I'm always like, criminal justice, the percentage of perpetrators that actually go to prison for their crimes, depending on where you're at in the country, is 2 to 5%. That's terrible. Those are terrible odds. But does that mean you shouldn't come forward? No, I think you should still come forward. I think you should report the person, even if you know that the odds are that they're not going to actually prosecute. You put their name in their system. They get put in CODIS so that, because repeat offenders, most predators are repeat offenders. They offend and offend and offend until they get caught. And so maybe the person isn't going to go to prison for what they did to you, but then they're going to do it again to somebody else. And then maybe that now triggers it. And then he will, or she will, or they will, for what they did to both people. So I still think it's not a hopeless effort to go forward to the police.
It's empowering.
Yeah. And you get to use your voice. It's also scary, right? Yeah. Which is why you need an advocate, I think, by your side to be there with you and tell you what your rights are. Super high odds.
Sorry to back up, but yeah. So the message, part of the message at least is, even if the evidence is weak, it's what she says versus what he says, and the prosecutor isn't really putting on a strong case, that doesn't mean you still shouldn't come forward and speak with someone who is a civil litigation attorney to at least inform them also, this is what's happened, what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, I think you should do both. But honestly, truthfully, it's up to a survivor. I don't get to choose. It's their life. And I support whatever decision they want to make. But I think, one, they should notify, call the police, so there's actually a report made. And then call a civil lawyer and talk to them. See what your other options are. And sometimes it's not just criminal or civil. There's other options. There's, let's say, for massage therapists. Unfortunately, that's a huge booming industry for sexual predators, is because why? You go behind the closed doors in a room, you're naked, they're massaging you, and then, you know, something bad happens. And so you can report to the California Massage Board. That's a third option. And guess what? They'll do an investigation. And if they find that that person sexually assaulted you, they lose their license. Then they can't work and hurt other people. So that's a great third option, which what the California Massage Board does is completely independent of what, you know, let's say the police do. They usually communicate, but just if the police department or the DA's office chooses not to prosecute, doesn't mean that the massage board's going to go, okay, well, because they didn't, I won't. They still will.
And at least filing the complaint, if they have a pattern of complaints.
You got it.
That'll help.
It's all about notice. Yeah. Notice, notice, notice. Put people on notice. There are bad people out there. We need to notify people. California has amazing protections too for survivors who tell their stories so that they won't be sued for for defamation. So, you know, putting up Yelp is a great thing too. We actually, in cases, when we're looking at whether we're going to take a case against certain, we read all the Yelp reviews. Did someone say, I got abused at this place? Guess what? Witness number one. We look for those things, and we also use it as notice against the companies. Because we'll say, it's negligent to not monitor your Yelp reviews.
That's very interesting. So you had someone come forward, and then when you went to look for witnesses, you were going through the Yelp reviews.
Yeah.
which are public right there. They have an account. They get a notification.
Yep. Or Google reviews. It's exactly right. And then we say, like, we just had a case right now we're litigating, and there were terrible Google reviews that said, don't go here. My wife went here. She was abused. This guy's a creeper. And it was, you know, a year before. And we said, well, what did you do? We deposed the person, and I had head of HR and head of the marketing department. What did you do when you read this review? Oh, we didn't read it. Or do you get a notification? Yes. So you got a notification that you got a new review. What'd you do with it? Oh, I sent it on. You sent it on. Then I say, well, the person who got it, what did you do with it? Well, we didn't do anything. So you didn't do an investigation. You didn't think that for the safety of your patients, that you deserved, you owed them the duty to at least just look into it. Oh, well, we asked the doctor and he said he didn't do it. And you thought that was enough? Well, yes. How stupid they look. What do you think a jury's going to think when they knew that some woman made a complaint and they asked the doctor who said they didn't do it? But guess what? They never even went and asked the woman. They never even called their patient to say, tell me what you saw. Tell me what happened. Or maybe the employees that were working with the doctor in the office that day. None of it.
I already see it. How reading Yelp or Google reviews can prevent sexual assault.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's transition for a moment over into, people talk about sexual assault, sexual harassment. I feel like they use it a little bit interchangeably.
Yeah.
And there's a clear delineation between some of it, but not all.
Right. So sexual harassment is sexual assault, but it's in the workplace. So under the law, we call sexual assault that happens at your job sexual harassment. Sometimes people think it's like a misnomer. They think sexual harassment is just verbal things, saying something inappropriate, hey, I like the way your butt looks today or something nonsense. But it actually involves also the physical touching. So it encompasses everything. And it's illegal. Okay. In California, and even though the EEOC right now federally is no longer doing investigations into discrimination as of right now.
What's the EEOC?
So EEOC is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It's a federal agency that is supposed to, if you feel like you've been sexually harassed at work, you can make a complaint to them. And then what would happen is they usually would then do an investigation into the alleged conduct. However, President Trump has recently announced in the last week that the EEOC will no longer he has halted all investigations into discrimination.
All right,
and so sexual harassment is discrimination based on sex. So in California, thankfully, we still have CRD, which is the civil rights department, which essentially does the same thing, but on a California level. So there still are government protections for people who've been sexually harassed. But you have to remember there's also the law. And the law says it is illegal to sexually harass a woman, man, person at work.
I can't imagine what that must be just to hear all this stuff, these stories, and absorb them and work in them and wake up and think about them at 4 a.m.
You know what I think? I think I better never go to prison, because if I ever went to prison, I don't know that I would survive. The guards would have it so out for me. It would be so terrible. I'd probably be murdered in prison.
And you said go to Aliceville.
No, absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
Absolutely not. They actually serve food there with maggots in it. And so you get your rape with a side of a mystery meat with some crawling in it.
It's more than I want with dinner.
I don't know. I feel like maybe I pick a Mexican prison. I don't know. At least I could pay somebody to like get out or get some food on the side. I could actually pay people. I think you actually, in other countries, people actually have to bring you food. But at least you'd be eating. I'd have organic, yummy food to eat.
Yes. Yes, you would.
I think the moral of the story is don't break the law. Don't break the law. Don't go to prison. But if you are going to go to prison, you are entitled to fair and humane treatment. So FCI Dublin, I think what is so important about this story is that it took one voice. One brave woman who came forward and called me and told me this story about how she was abused there. And from that started, the dominoes just started to topple. And I say this so many times, and I think sometimes people think it's cliche, but this story more than ever really demonstrates that you matter. Your voice matters. And you have the power to create change by speaking up. She took on a system, not just a system. She took on the United States of America and said, it is not okay. It is not part of my sentence. You do not get to abuse me this way. And I'm going to hold you accountable. And she did. She did. So I hope for other survivors out there who are listening to this story, they realize that they have power. They have power to get justice. And that justice isn't just an ideal. Justice is a reality that all of us are entitled to.
We thank you for being here, telling us so many more of the details that people cannot find out in public. And I greatly appreciate you coming on Cases for Causes.
Thank you so much for having me.